So for those of you who didn't hear what that was question was about, it was a question about somebody who submitted an exemption application for a 501c4 organization, which used to be on Form 1024 and is now on Form 1024A. There you go. They got a letter back from the IRS saying, we will expedite this ruling for you if you will agree to limit your political activities to a certain percentage of your activities. And this is a great opportunity to distinguish these lobbying limits from the limits on political activity. Because, of course, a 501c4 has no limits on lobbying, but there are limits on how much political activity that we'll talk about in a second. As a result of the scandal, and those of you listening to this on tape didn't see my air quotes there, that broke in 2013, a bunch of reforms and attempted reforms happened with regard to how the IRS evaluated exemption applications from 501c4s, and in particular, how they could expedite those that involved some possible political activity. And one of the results was this expedited letter. This is basically a safe harbor that the IRS has carved out that says, if you're willing to arguably restrict your political activities more than you could push the envelope and do otherwise, we will not make you go through a long, drawn-out process of additional questions and so forth. And it's a really case-by-case situation as to whether or not your C4 should accept that. I've had clients who both said, sure, we're not going to go anywhere near those lines. Give me the determination letter right away. And I've had clients who said, yeah, no, we really want to push it a little harder. Why don't you actually rule on our ruling? So, but a digression into electoral activity. Let me finish the lobbying activity for C3s. The other problem with the no substantial part test, apart from the fact that we don't know how much substantial is that we also don't actually know what lobbying is or how to measure it. Because this is not an expenditure-based test, and it doesn't have any definitions associated with it. We think we know a little bit about the definitions because the law was somewhat based on the rules that applied to private foundations before the enactment of the 1969 Act or the 1976 Act. But we're not entirely sure. And we know because the 990 asks about it on Schedule C, where you report your lobbying activities, that it wants to know about more than money. Be aware that no substantial part is full of vagueness. It does have some exceptions that are similar to 501H, but again, you're not allowed to use the 501H definitions.
I was just going to ask. In my previous role, we had we decided to set up a 501c3 public charity. At that time, we had a private foundation and a 501c4. And I'll admit, in the cone of silence of this room, that we were rather hurried in that process, and we just made the 501H election. Without giving it much thought. For any organization that's shy of those thresholds, either the million total or the 250 on grassroots, do you have a general guidance on which way you direct your clients?
If your budget's 20 million bucks a year or above, don't make the 501H election. That's my general rule. I could argue for a higher or lower limit. Mathematically, you hit the $1 million limit when you're at 17 million. At some point, it's worth foregoing the clarity of 501H to not make the election. It also matters if you are planning to do a lot of your lobbying as grassroots lobbying. I might even argue for a lower limit if you're doing grassroots lobbying, because no substantial part does not distinguish between direct and grassroots lobbying.
What expenses exactly are included in grassroots lobbying?
The expenses, well, we're going to talk 501H here, not no substantial part, because I can tell you the answer for 501H. If you are incurring an expense in terms of staff time, an allocable share of overhead, and all of the direct costs to make a communication or hold an event or put out a publication that, number one, expresses a view, two, on a specific legislative policy proposal, not merely things that have been introduced as bills, but any specific legislative solution to a problem that you'd like to see enacted at the federal, state, or local level. And you're communicating with the general public or some subset of that, and you include one of the clearly delineated in the regulations grassroots lobbying calls to action, which essentially is that part of the communication that says, hey, contact your lawmakers about this. So for example, if you've got on your website a take action page where you put up alerts about, you know, some great piece of legislation you'd like to see passed or some horrific piece of legislation you'd like to see defeated, the cost of that online tool, of developing that portion of your website, the cost of the staff time to write the alerts that you email out directing people to that website, all of those are grassroots lobbying communications. You can, you know, be strategic about this by using that tool for both legislative advocacy and non-lobbying administrative advocacy so that you can divvy up the costs between grassroots lobbying and non-lobbying. But if you have a lobby day and you rent a hall and an AV system and you pay staff to be there and maybe some transportation costs, you know, buses to truck people into Washington, that's going to be probably a grassroots lobbying thing. So all of that kind of thing.